Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 215, recorded for June 7th, 2023. The Cloud Pod breaks into the quantum safe. Good evening, Ryan and Matt. Justin is on a, he says, well-deserved vacation, but that's a matter of perspective, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, what has he done for us lately?
He's not here.
Didn't invite us to his cruise, I'll tell you that.
Right? Yeah.
All right. We will get going. We're going to alternate through stories. If one of us sucks, the next one hopefully won't quite so much.
I apologize in advance.
Yep. Okay. In general news, the Terraform AWS provider has been updated to version 5.0 and adds support for default tags. This year, HashiCorp will focus. Was it HashiCorp? No, it's AWS provider, right?
I think it's joint.
They have focused on improving the user experience for practitioners by adding several new services to the AWS provider, that being Amazon CloudWatch Observability Access Manager, the EC2 Recycle Bin, Amazon QuickSight, Amazon VPC Lattice, Directory Service, Trust Relationships, and Amazon EventBridge Pipes. Default tags are now available in the provider, allowing practitioners to define common metadata tags at the provider level, which are then applied to all supported resources in the Terraform configuration. New features in the Terraform plugin SDK and Terraform plugin framework have removed several limitations which made default tags difficult to integrate into existing resource models. Updates in version 5 solve for inconsistent final plans, identical tags, and perpetual diffs with tag configurations.
I hate it that I'm still finding out about AWS services from like Terraform provider announcements, but you know, it is sort of sometimes the way you learn. Like I've talked several times about instead of reconstructing or reading API docs, like just reading the Terraform provider docs.
Honestly, I think I normally look at the Terraform docs to figure out how things work much more than I actually go read any cloud's documentation. It's just easier and it's consistent across all the clouds at this point too, which is nice.
I was unaware of the recycle bin, actually. That was one thing.
Yeah,
that's the one that
caught me off guard, too. I'm like, what is this?
I was surprised by the EventBridge pipes. I'm not familiar with... I know EventBridge. Not sure what the pipes feature is.
We're going to have a Matt did a thing next week.
Yeah, I know. I think I do remember that one being announced. I mean, it was funny. In the pre-show, we were discussing like my knowledge of how default tags work. And I was surprised that they're actually implemented at the provider level and not just part of Terraform itself. Just goes to show how like I haven't been diving under the hood as much lately. But this feature is a pretty rad feature, just as someone who has to combat tagging and tag strategy and policing tags on resources. Like the simpler the better for these things. So it's good.
It's a very nice feature that I think the first thing I did when I started to use Terraform on Azure was, hey, let me go jump in and see if it has this. And it's like, as soon as it was released on Azure, like a week or two, or on AWS, a week or two later, there's a GitHub issue for the Azure to implement it. And then in the pre-show, I looked at GCP and there's another GitHub issue for that one. Everyone's like, we want this because tagging everything independently is very annoying. But the inconsistencies they solved here is very nice because like I remember the AWS auto-scaling group one like had to have its own special tags, even if you use the default tag. So it's nice that they've just standardized it at this point, because this was actually like a middle of three or middle of four provider. Like it wasn't released with like a major release. It was like, here's a minor release and here's this awesome feature that no one talks about.
It's kind of cool. I think it's a neat hack as well as a way of AWS providing a really useful feature without having to do any work, like on the cloud platform itself. Just implement it in the tool that does the deployment, rather than having a service which could do it for you.
Hmm. I mean, each individual API still has to support the tagging tag construct, so I don't know if it's really saving them a whole much, but I get it.
What, you like config watching every single event that occurs and then triggering an event if this isn't there and then adding the tags?
Not as much as I like org policies, just randomly denying my resource deployments because it doesn't meet my tagging policy.
I feel like there's a story behind that.
Oh, not a specific one, just more a general sort of, if you manage things at the organization level, it's a really just crappy user experience for your cloud users.
Yeah. I just feel like there was a story of you sitting down one night trying to launch something quickly and swearing profusely at something while it tried to launch and couldn't.
That's every day. Getting
rejected until you went up the stack.
Yeah. Every day. Yeah. Like, some policy I probably implemented myself that I'm now violating. All right. Now moving on to AWS. AWS DMS Serverless automatically provisions and scales capacity for migration and data replication. It's a new service that provides a service experience for data migration and replication. It automatically provisions and scales capacity based on demand, eliminating the need to provision and manage servers. Supports a variety of data sources and destinations, including Amazon S3, Amazon Redshift, and Amazon Aurora. And DMS Serverless supports Microsoft SQL, Postgres, MySQL, Oracle as data sources. And for targets, it also supports Aurora, RDS, S3, Redshift, and DynamoDB. And it is available in preview now.
That's cool. I guess that will really help reduce the cost of the beginning of the migration process, like where you don't want this massive bill in the first month just because you've got these servers stood up that no one's going to use for 3 or 4 months. It's easy to get the simple stuff out of the way, like deploying these clusters, but if you're not going to use them, then why bother? And having it on demand like this is pretty neat.
See, I was also thinking about it at the end of the migration, like, okay, we finally got it all replicated. Now we're going to wait a month before we actually cut over. We need this very small change rate versus let's go replicate everything, you know, at the very beginning. So to kind of just keep it in sync. So like in theory, it goes up and down. And you're not provisioning based on peak capacity too.
Yeah, I've never been able to actually implement DMS. I've had it in my crosshairs many a times. I've never been able to get those projects off the ground, largely just because, you know, I haven't been able to convince anyone of, you know, of replicating, you know, the main data set and then the delta at cutover time is a safe and sane way to do it. But yeah, no, I like services like this. And, if, you know, I never really thought about maintaining servers, or I thought it was more managed than it is, apparently. But it's great that it's serverless now.
On to Snowball Edge storage optimized devices with more storage and bandwidth. AWS has announced new Snowball Edge storage optimized device with more storage and bandwidth. The new devices offer up to 1 terabyte of storage and 10 gigabits of bandwidth. They're designed for customers who move massive amounts of data to and from AWS. These devices can be set up and deployed easily.
In minutes, no less. It's kind of weird.
I'm just wondering when Snowball Edge devices are going to catch up to the snow machines. You know, the trucks, like 100 terabytes, we got to be in close.
Not until you can drive it. That's really, like, I don't care how much storage it holds, but I want to be able to drive it around. Like anything I order from Amazon, I want to be able to ride it.
I just want the 2 armored car drivers surrounding me when I drive.
Yeah, they pitch that as protecting your data, but actually it's protecting the multi-million dollar truck that's parked outside the building while they suck out all your data. It's slightly bizarre that it's, I mean, what's traditionally like a storage device, that they would call it a storage optimized device when it's designed to be a storage device in the first place. I mean, I know it does compute as well, very poorly.
I think they're pushing more for telemetry data too, like, hey, go launch this in this remote location and then be able to actually, you know, collect all this stuff and then just send it back. So in an area that is not, you know, doesn't have internet or something like that, be able to actually collect all your data in real time, send it back, and then analyze it after. So I think that's why they're trying to add more storage and everything along those lines.
That's a lot of storage. That's a lot of data they're collecting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really an announcement for, like, you know, the Raspberry Pi duct tape to the hard drive is bigger now, right? That's just it.
Yeah. Yeah, take a $30 Raspberry Pi and rent it out for $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
Good business.
Genius.
All right, the Amazon Security Lake is now generally available. Amazon Security Lake is a fully managed service that makes it easy to store, analyze, and protect your security and compliance data. It provides a unified platform for security and compliance teams to collect, store, and analyze data from a variety of sources, including S3, Amazon CloudTrail, and Amazon GuardDuty. Security Lake provides a centralized repository for security and compliance data. Sounds like a great plan. It offers a variety of tools and services for analyzing and visualizing said data, and helps you identify and remediate risks. And it also helps you meet compliance requirements by checking those boxes.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's part of us that misses the lightning round, because I could not read through this story without thinking through just like snarky responses. Like, now you can drown yourself in the Amazon security link. You know, it is. It's just one of those things. So it's hilarious to me. These are great things. I think it's fantastic, you know, because a lot of times this data is being collected anyway, and it's being stored across many different devices and S3 buckets, and it's all over the place. And at least this will put it all in one place where hopefully it's a little bit more usable. But also the main benefit is that it's going to be easy to visualize the cost of this, because a lot of security logging isn't really utilized, but it's stored sometimes for very long periods of time without actually providing any value. Sometimes you can't even search it. You can't even hydrate it into something where you can, you know, until you have to for like a security response. And so I do like this tool as much as I want to make fun of it.
It's nice also that they're verticalizing these. You know, there was the HIPAA one a while ago. There's the security one. There's the general data leak. So I'm hoping that, you know, one day I'll play with this and actually be able to say, oh, okay, they actually optimize this like for security in these ways versus like we just rebranded the normal lake into a security lake.
Yeah. Like if the pricing is based on the fact that you're going to write this data and never read it before you delete it, then that would be nice. Yeah, it's one of those things that you don't need until you do, once every how many years. But when you do need it, it's desperate.
And you really don't want to ever have to need it. It means you're having a really bad day.
Moving on. Announcing the AWS Blueprint for Ransomware Defense. The Blueprint for Ransomware Defense is a comprehensive framework that helps organizations protect themselves against ransomware attacks. The framework includes best practices for security, compliance, and disaster recovery. Is based on AWS security services, because it would be foolish to leverage, you know, other cloud providers. And the solutions can be customized to meet the specific needs of your organization. The framework is designed to help organizations reduce the risk of ransomwares or minimize the impact of attack if it occurs and recover quickly. It's one of those things where you don't have to make up your own designs and you can just leverage Amazon, which is why we love cloud services. Fantastic. It comprises of 29 pages of prescriptive guidance and links associated to NIST controls. And what isn't to love with a whole bunch of 29 pages of NIST controls? But that's some good reading.
That's a lot of controls. Like step one, buy yourself a ticket to the Bahamas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Write two letters, right?
Yeah. Yep.
It's interesting. They're putting all these announcements out right before Reinforce too. So I'm curious to see maybe if they're going to have some really good stuff at Reinforce this year. Because yeah. I think it's in June.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. Like it is
June 13th.
It is absolutely, you know, it could be, and ransomware, you know, if you're announcing a major security product, right, ransomware would be a pretty, pretty good one, because lots of people would be willing to just check easy boxes and easy buttons.
Will they publish the ransomware defense a week before they announce some major change to their response to ransomware defense? I don't know.
You know, you're holding me hostage. So you can either buy this product or read 29 pages of NIST controls. Guess what I'm doing? Checkbook, please.
Not sure who's holding
someone who's else's checkbook.
Yeah.
I guess it's nice to have a plan, a robust plan that your vendor also uses. Because I'm sure as there are more and more high-profile ransomware cases in the news, vendor management questions are going to start, including, do you have a plan to deal with ransomware and what is it? And so, you know, the easy, well, this is what we use. Amazon uses the same thing. It's probably a huge time save.
Yeah. And I already read white pages for, you know, how to do deployments at scale and all these things. And, you know, there's no reason why ransomware attack shouldn't be exactly the same thing, something I can reference. Even if I'm designing myself, I can at least read this and see if I discovered something that I hadn't quite considered or control that I wasn't quite meeting. Or, you know, maybe, you know, there's a better way to do this. So it is pretty, I do like that companies are providing, especially Amazon, this sort of blueprint.
Yeah. What if it addresses actually paying people to get your data back?
You know? it should. Honestly, it should. Like, yeah. You know, like, here's the things to consider. Like, not tell you one way or the other, because it's got to be it's a very personal decision for your company, but should probably have a list of at least like, maybe. Should never negotiate with terrorists. See official CloudPod stance. Complaints can be sent to Justin at cloudpod.net because he's not here.
All right, let's move on to some GCP news. There is a full one story ready for today. Security Command Center, also known as SCC Premium, pricing for project planned activation is 25% lower. Customers who use SCC to secure their compute engine, GKE Autopilot app engine, and Cloud SQL now will receive a price cut. We also have expanded the number of findings available in the premium activations.
So I'm probably biased because of my personal experience with SCC, but like, it's priced very, very high, and it is very hard to roll it out at scale with its pricing model. So this, you know, I feel is a necessary move to make it competitive, which is good. And I can never complain about price cuts. It is a fairly comprehensive tool. Like, I do really like it, but it is priced in such a way and designed in such a way that makes it really hard to defend.
What is that like exactly? I'm not familiar. Is it like per project, per workspace, per machine, per resource? Like, how is it calculated?
Yeah. So,
and you want to give us five of what the tool actually is? Because apparently you're now the expert. Congratulations.
Crap. So the pricing model varies by resource. That's the first thing that makes it sort of like, I don't like this. It is complex to sort of figure out the pricing model. And it really depends on what you have deployed and what extent of those deployments you have in your ecosystem. It is comprehensive across all the projects in your org, and it does cover and aggregate basically, logging and API actions and security findings sort of in one place on a dashboard right for security. So it's, think of it like if to translate in AWS terms, it'd be like guard duty. And so, it allows you a place to aggregate, different sources for security exploits, and as well as it provides some alerting and eventing based off suspicious behavior.
Is 25% enough of a price cut, you think, to make it competitive?
I don't think I'm well positioned to make that determination, just because the position I was in when I was doing the evaluation was, trying to evaluate the future potential use. And so I was really trying to argue for any value. And that's, that was a specific to that org and the whole types of things. And so I think it's, like any other cloud tool, you're going to have to look at your workloads and think about your resourcing. And unfortunately, in this case, it's super complex to figure out the different resource models. But, I think that depending on your workload, I think it can be reasonable for sure.
Okay. All right. Moving on to Azure. Building a quantum safe future. Quantum computers are still in their early stages of development, but they do have the potential to break current encryption standards. That was one of my predictions a couple of years ago. Still hasn't happened, as far as we know. But soon, though. Very soon. I'm going to keep putting it on my predictions list every year until it happens now. It is a dead cert. And to go off on a tangent, there's rumors that lots of sort of state-sponsored data collection is happening of encrypted data off from the internet, whether it's credit card transactions or anything else, in the hopes that eventually all that will be very easy to decrypt, which is kind of worrying. And there's not really much we can do about it, unfortunately, apart from going and living in a cave someplace and bartering for potatoes. But so be it. But Microsoft is working on developing quantum-safe cryptography, which will be resistant to attacks by quantum computers until they're not. It's essential to protect sensitive data such as financial information, intellectual property, even health information, I guess. Microsoft's working with partners in the public and private sectors to develop these new standards and get it deployed widely. Quantum safe cryptography is a critical part of Microsoft's commitment to building a secure and trusted future.
As long as they're first, right?
They're also building the quantum computers that they're going to crack the stuff. So, they've got the fingers in both pies, as it were.
Turtles all the way down. Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to, I suppose. It's sort of where does one stop and the other begin?
At one point, they're building protections against something that they know is going to come, but they don't know how it's going to affect it.
But they're enabling the thing that's going to require the safety. Yeah.
But can you build a safety standard against something that doesn't exist yet?
It's the easiest safety standard to build, right?
Well, no one's going to complain that they're wrong. No one's going to complain that they're wrong until it happens, I guess. It gives them pretty good lead time to fix it. There is a bit of like self-fulfilling prophecy about the whole thing, though.
Yeah.
I struggle. I mean, I understand a little bit about quantum computing and the types of operations that they can do, but I do struggle to think that it would be impossible to work around these new algorithms. And even if you didn't work around with a quantum computer, then you still have traditional computers and vastly powerful AIs to try and figure things out as well at this point. So I think that's probably a risk which is getting up there as far as cracking encryption.
I mean, it's like encryption standards over time, right? Like it used to be that, 128-bit encryption was fine, but then our computers got fast enough to where now it's like you need something more like 512. And all you're really trying to do is make it long enough where it's less attractive to throw a lot of computers at it, right? Where it's, it's 1,000 years of very expensive computers to get my Netflix password.
Is it password 123?
Damn it. Don't, it's on the podcast. Netflix gets all mad about sharing those things now.
I forget the exclamation mark on the end. Password 123 exclamation mark.
Let me go change my luggage code.
Nice. Next up from Azure, reflections on AI and the future of human flourishing. Dun, dun, dun. Microsoft published a blog article on AI. Of course they did. It has the potential to be a powerful tool for good, you don't say. But it is important to use AI responsibly. Cool. AI should be developed and used in a way that benefits all of humanity, not just a select few. I agree with that one. Fine. It is important to have diversity of voices involved in the development of AI so that it reflects the needs of people. And the blog post highlights Microsoft's need to be prepared for potential negative impacts of AI, such as job displacement and bias. Microsoft needs to have a clear understanding of the ethical implications of AI and develop safeguards against the protection and misuse. The blog post also talks about Microsoft's need to invest in research on the potential benefits and risks of AI so that we can make informed decisions on how to develop and use it. Isn't that what we need AI for, to make all these decisions? Keep us real safe? Like, what could go wrong? The blog post talks about Microsoft's need to have a public conversation about the future of AI, which I assume this blog post is meant to provide. And it wants to promote the ability for everyone to have a say in how AI is developed and used.
I mean, that's a great ideal, but of course we know that's not going to happen. I think one of the most difficult things is going to be, the diversity piece is very interesting to me, because right now, things like ChatGPT, GPT-4, Bard, they're all trained on massively trawled data sets from the internet. There's an awful lot of information which isn't on the internet to begin with. There's also a lot of bias, a lot of copies of things, repeated things. There's a whole bunch of crap on the internet, which means that these models, as Facebook found out, can become racist or sexist or any kind of ist that you can imagine. And so a lot of work gets put into either sort of filtering the original data set or testing the models afterwards, where they, there's a news article about how OpenAI was paying people $10 an hour or something to basically feed in prompts and then rate the answers as to whether or not they were acceptable or not. But of course, that in itself is very unobjective. I think the way you train an AI for the United States and the types of things which are acceptable will be completely different than if you were to run the same type of service in, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Turkey or England, for that matter. And so I think diversity is an important piece, and being able to provide models which are suitable for the audience or the country or the population in general is going to be super important. Otherwise, there's going to be huge pushback against, political agendas or ideological agendas and things. It's going to be super hard to navigate that, and very expensive as well, because now you'll have to have teams of different people all providing their feedback. I don't know how you can sort of make these models make everyone happy in a way.
Yeah, localization for AI is going to be a thing, right? We're just not there yet. It is a very difficult challenge, and labeling and machine learning, that's been around for a while, and I still don't know a really good solution other than what people do, which is Mechanical Turk it out and just pay a lot of people a little bit of money to go and just do some subset. So I imagine the same thing will happen with localization, and we'll see how good that turns out. And I think it's like any new internet technology, it's gonna suck for a long time. search results when Google first came out were terrible, but over time it'll get better, and hopefully it gets better responsibly and doesn't spawn robots that want to kill us all.
I mean, to me, it's a lot around the guardrails that we put on the AI that in theory protect, it from taking over the world, of, hey, what are the things that you can do? What are the things you can't do? And what are the responses, or like, hey, somebody writes, this really long, suicide note. Okay, immediately give them this, like even having pre-canned answers to help, with a lot of that, but putting those guardrails in and those, hey, by default, if somebody writes, 911 in the US, and maybe this goes to the localization aspect, or was it 999 in the UK, it automatically send a message to police, but put those guardrails or these default actions in place, thus that, it is always helping and hopefully not hurting much.
I think the trick for any of the guardrails or data curation is each one of those points is a place where you can influence and bias the machine and the model, right? And so I think that's really the challenge. How many, we've read articles about, ChatGPT and the things that they edit it so it won't say. And I've hit a couple things, trying to play around with it where the second time you ask it, a couple of weeks later, like it's answering very differently. It's very clear that there's a change, right? And so, it's depending on who's doing that and how much they're paying attention to bias and diversity. It's very tricky. It's going to be hard. It's going to take a long time to figure out. It's going to be bumpy as we get there.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of like the nuclear race in a way. A lot of research went into the consequences of nuclear weapons before they were built and before they were deployed. I kind of felt like we've missed the boat a little bit on this, and we've built these massive tools, and now we're thinking about analyzing the risks and the benefits.
I mean, I don't know. I think that thinking about responsible AI has been around for quite a bit too.
Yeah, for sure.
I definitely don't want to say, oh, well, we didn't get started, so let's not do it. It's better late than never in this case, I think.
I mean, some of it is that, large companies built these, not, the government, who can say, hey, let's go spend millions of dollars, looking at these consequences before we actually go do a thing, versus, all these companies have stockholders and, board of directors and, employees that they have to respond to. So sometimes, it's different angles. When I worked for the government, somebody told me at one point, the government's not designed to be efficient. Like, it's just not what they are. It's a different world there. So, they in order to, like you said, understand nuclear weapons, they did the research and the analysis on it before they did it. Companies aren't going to do that because they need to get a thing out quickly. And you can see it by, OpenAI, ChatGPT came out, and all of a sudden Google's like, hey, wait, we're here. We've been doing this for a while. We got Bard. Don't forget about us, because they had stockholders and board of directors that I'm sure were yelling at everyone, being like, wait, 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 but they're doing it. Why aren't we doing it?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Google had Bard around or whatever was
internal code name
turned into Bard internally for a very long time, and have been working on this. Most of the technology came from Google to begin with. The I don't know. I will say one thing for OpenAI though. in themselves, I like that they're not publicly owned. So they're not shareholders to please. They're not being pushed by anyone, by investors, at least as, you know, that we can tell, to rush things out, to do certain things, to monetize in a particular way. You know, that there won't be shareholder lawsuits against the executive team for OpenAI for doing things or not doing things, which I like. I appreciate that Sam Altman is, you know, didn't take stock in the company. He gets, I mean, he doesn't need money. He's been, you know, he could retire and not can be concerned with that at all. He takes a salary. He didn't take stock. He's not sort of in it for the money, I don't think. There's some really good interviews with him, which I've listened to. And I can't think of a more down-to-earth, thoughtful guy to be in control of the technology, which he has kind of at his fingertips right now. So that's kind of nice. I guess like a lot of the people have thought about AI and the consequences over the years, mostly being quite negative, though. I think, you know, Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity book talks about the consequences of AI and what will happen when we kind of get to where we are today. And then you've got sci-fi, which has talked about it and glossed over the bad stuff. And isn't it cool that you can talk to your computer and ask it to do things? And that's the really cool part for me, at least. I want the Star Trek computer to ask questions and complex questions that require, you know, thought and everything else. So I'm excited for the future of AI. And I think, yes, it's going to displace a whole lot of jobs, but it will create new opportunities. I don't know. I think governments...
Any advancement in technology has that. Yeah. Built into it, right?
I think what should probably happen is that services like this with such potential to disrupt the economy and the workforce should probably be taxed really heavily, and that money should be put aside and then used to kind of compensate people.
Yeah.
It's like everyone has this great idea. Well, the robots will come and do our work, and we can just spend all our time just leisurely sitting on the beach and listening to music and, you know, being very hedonistic and going back to the Renaissance kind of lifestyle, for example. We'll have patrons and we can just live life for the purpose of living life. Of course, that's not going to be the reality at all.
Wait, it's not?
Sadly, no. Sorry to burst the bubble, but...
Oh, wait, I'm going to have to do this computer thing forever?
Someone's still going to reboot the AI computer once a week since it runs on Windows now.
Too close to home.
Maybe that's the benefit of the partnership with Microsoft, actually, that it's running on Windows and they have to reboot it once every week. So if it goes
Patch
rogue,
Tuesday, man.
If it goes rogue, Tuesday comes around, it's all going to fail anyway. We're safe.
It will clean itself up. Yeah. It's fine. Someone will hack the AI and we'll, you know, be in a different world at that point.
Yeah, that's kind of fun. Have you been waiting months and months to hire your new AWS GCP or Azure architect only to have them be poached at the 11th hour by a startup with a juice bar? Initiative stalled because you're having trouble hiring? Well, I have a simple solution. Foghorn Consulting. Foghorn Consulting provides top-notch cloud engineers to the world's most innovative companies and can be burning down your DevOps and cloud backlogs as soon as next week. Foghorn certified AWS, GCP, and Azure professionals are armed with infrastructure as code, and from day one will be designing performant, optimized cloud native or hybrid environments that deliver on the promise of cloud. Their FogOps solution even provides on-demand cloud engineering to augment your existing teams. Visit www.foghornconsulting.com or send an email to cloudtalentnow@foghornconsulting.com and tell them the CloudPod sent you. Your dedicated FogOps team is with you for the long haul, and they bring their own juice.
All right. So to continue our AI conversation, Microsoft has announced the Azure AI Content Safety Public Preview, a new suite of AI tools to help companies protect their users from harmful content. The tool can be used to detect, remove content that is harmful, including sexual abuse material, violence, and hate speech. The tools are available to all Azure customers, and Microsoft is working with partners to make them available to more organizations.
Yeah, so if you were wondering why Microsoft felt the need to, you know, publish a blog post with a deep, you know, thought experiment about, you know, being responsible with AI and Microsoft's responsibility, now you know, because they also now offer a service and public preview where you can give them money.
So from a hackathon years ago that I don't know if Jonathan was a part of, I know that Microsoft actually helped build a tool to protect against child pornography. You know, obviously we built this whole serverless solution that ran on Amazon. You know, it's a long story. I'm sure I'll think I wrote a blog post about it for my old company that maybe we can link to in the show notes if I actually did that thing.
You did.
That I said I was going to do. Or
but
I
think now we have Peter, to find it in the show notes. So thanks for the extra work.
Anytime. I delegate that to you, Ryan. But, you know, I know that this is something that they've been doing for years, you know, and I know that the tool that we built this serverless solution for, that the solution didn't actually work at the end of the day because, you know, it required a full-blown Windows server to be running. But Microsoft actually provided a lot of these tools to companies and to non-for-profits in the for free. So it's interesting now that they're taking this and trying to make this more available to a broader audience.
I'm trying to remember the name of the company who sponsored the hackathon, the nonprofit hackathon. Who was it? Began with a T.
If my internet was faster, we'd know.
I don't think it's with a T. Thorn.
Thorn?
I think that if it started with a T, I think it was Thorn.
That doesn't matter. Yeah, we'll try and find the story. We'll link to it. And you won the hackathon, right? With that solution?
I thought you joined that.
No, yet. I didn't join that there. Or was that with? I joined the other year with the. Apparently it's too late today. They gave away the greatest orange socks, which I still have.
You are in the picture, Jonathan. Oh, yeah. So it feels like you are part
of
the team.
It was the Twitch thing, wasn't it? We built the donations like bot thing for Twitch, so people could click on links and donate money to charitable drives on people's Twitch channels.
Yeah, so this was the 2017 non-for-profit hackathon at AWS reInvent. Apparently, we wrote CloudFormation.
And it was Thorn. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I have the link.
So without Justin here, the podcast is hosted entirely by reInvent hackathon winners.
No. I have never won one.
Yeah. Did you join?
Mm-mm. No. Mm. So...
Ryan, you have to leave. I'm sorry.
I will be showing my way.
Yeah, off the island.
Yeah.
Yes. Matt decided he was going to like spill coffee all over his laptop and trash it the morning of the hackathon. So he spent half the time running around Vegas trying to get a replacement, and then still claimed the title.
Which is pretty impressive.
It's yeah.
Like winning it with one hand tied behind your back. It's pretty awesome.
Hey, after the first year winning, I had to make it harder the second year.
All right, we should get back on track to whatever we're doing here.
Yes. Oh, we're doing a podcast. Oh, wow.
We are. I prefer the chat, though, honestly. So it's a lot
no
fun.
One's listening by now.
Yeah. They've already turned it off. It's fine. They're like, just as I hear, this is going south quickly.
Yeah.
Final story for Azure. The Azure load balancer per VM limit has been removed. This is the NLBs. They used to be an arbitrary limit of... two load balancer attachments for a VM, and that's now been removed. Used to be one public and one internal. You can now associate as many load balancers per VM as you like.
Just one of those features where it was like, yeah, I don't use Azure much, but I didn't know that this was a limitation, and it would have completely, like, if I would have read this, I would have been like, I'm not using that ever.
Yeah, no apologies.
This is a good limit to remove.
Yeah, no.
I just want to know what caused it. Yeah. Like, what was the technical limitation that was in place that caused this limit to have to occur?
Yeah, it's a weird way of thinking. It's like you think you deploy a load balancer and then it has targets and it keeps track of its targets and health checks and other pieces. It's like it's a weird bottom-up kind of, why would a VM have a limitation on the number of load balancers that could be attached? Unless it's something kind of like the network fabric layer that they did something clever with. And because it's NLBs, it does some magic or whatever. And they finally found a way to work around that. Little strange, and the announcement they made was probably fewer words than we've already spoken in talking about this.
Yeah, so. Definitely. Yeah, and very light on the details. My guess was 802.1 queue tagging. Like, that's the only thing I could think of, right? And so they had a separation of internal networks and public networks, and they had their own tags and done so, you know, which just doesn't scale past that. So I mean, just hopefully replace the whole mechanism. But that's, you know, it's stretching the limits of my network knowledge, which is mostly the magic sauce underneath. That I think there's smoke involved. That's how the bits get there. I don't know.
And magnets. So. Definitely magnets.
Mm-hmm. And tubes. Don't forget the tubes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the vacuum tubes that like suck the messages back and forth between the VMs and things. That's
Yeah, when you reboot the server, all they're doing is just cleaning the tubes. Didn't you know that?
Yeah, makes sense.
I thought they actually sent somebody into the data center to press the button on the machine. It is the Azure we talked about still, right?
It's just PowerShell scripts that are put together to make things run. That's what I've decided.
That's a little too close to home. All right, moving on. Before you talk about PowerShell some more. So Will's talking about in our next in our cloud journey series, cloud native multi-cloud, which feels like we talk about this all the time. this multi-cloud strategy. Do you guys like clouds? Do you like more than one cloud? How do you feel about clouds?
We have talked a lot about multi-cloud in various contexts over the past 215 episodes.
14
episodes. Thank you. Plus extras, plus interviews, plus everything else. I guess for me, I think as off the block, I would not want to. I don't want multi-cloud to be the first choice. It's something I think you would deal with if you had to, but that it shouldn't be your first choice. Like if you're a small business and you're delivering some kind of software as a service or something else, like, you know, say you got a WordPress site, do you want multi-cloud? No, absolutely not. That would be ridiculous. There are times, I think, in the life cycle of a business where multi-cloud makes sense. You may inherit somebody else's deployments if you make an acquisition. You know, maybe there's some really compelling service that another cloud offers that yours doesn't. In the case, you know, if you're an Azure customer, for example.
Hey.
We pray for you.
We do. Sorry. But yeah, I don't think, I think that there's pros and cons to it. I think it can get very expensive very quickly.
It's also a matter of doing it right. Doing one cloud correct is hard. Doing multiple clouds correct is, dare I say, impossible. I mean, unless if you have a team that's large enough. So if you're a massive company, you know, or inherited, you know, like you said, through an acquisition or something. But, you know, any small and medium-sized company, choose a cloud, I feel. I mean, my gut is, you know, off the cuff is normally choose a cloud and just deal with its limitations, you know, and make a best decision you can at the beginning, you know, and kind of go from there. Every cloud has its limits. Every cloud has where it's good. You know, every cloud has where it's not good. You know, but choose something and go with it. Don't, you know, you'll get killed in the complexity of everything otherwise. There are definitely things that work better in some clouds than others. Like, say, BigQuery works extremely well compared to, you know, its competitors, but Azure SQL with, you know, elastic pools is a concept that doesn't exist in any other clouds where it just works better. So, you know, there's concepts everywhere that work. There's things that put works. But unless if you're a larger company, I agree with Jonathan, you know, choose something to go with it at the beginning.
Yeah, I almost feel like no one should purposely choose a multi-cloud strategy. It should always be like slightly against your will. And, you know, for the same reason, like, you know, it's a feature you desperately need, or it's an acquisition, you know, and until you are forced to, I don't think that you should really spend time trying to keep your workload agnostic or trying to focus only on technologies that are portable. I think a true multi-cloud strategy is really focusing on the benefits of that cloud. Like if you've got a large investment in data centers and you can make your total cost of ownership for storage or what have you super cheap, like leave it, right? Like it definitely until your hardware depreciates in value. But, you know, going all in and like Anthos day one so that you can do Kubernetes across any cloud that you want. And I don't think it's really worth it. And you'll spend all your time chasing your tail for sure.
And also, you're not going to get any benefits of the first cloud. Like, part of the benefits and part of the way to, you know, increase velocity, you know, and really just get the cost savings and everything is leveraging the services of the cloud. Leverage the passes, leverage the, you know, managed services. You know, don't try to build your own database. You know, you're going to get no advantage of doing that versus, you know, launching your SQL or your RDS or your Google SQL, you know, service. You know, sure, yeah, we can launch that in a, you know, an EC2 instance on a virtual machine and go from there. But, you know, you're not going to get any benefits of the cloud. Like, go in, like, don't, to me, if you're going to go with a multi-cloud, like Ryan said, like, you really need to have almost a team of people that know each cloud at that point and can help you leverage that cloud for that workload. And that's where you really can get the multi-cloud is, you know, hey, we're going to put this, you know, use the right tools, the right place, at the right time. So, you know, hey, this Microsoft workload, maybe it goes to Microsoft. Hey, this big data workload, maybe it goes to, you know, Google, GCP. And, you know, kind of go from there, you know, and build it out that way. But small, medium, even large until you reach massive Fortune 500 companies, probably not worth it, you know, unless if you spend a lot of time in your set, you know, see the prior one of the Center of Excellence. And whether it's a public cloud center of excellence that, you know, has sub teams or a COE for each cloud at that point.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, a key thing I see a lot is people sort of misplacing the value, right? You think about, you know, running a database, you know, on a compute node in a cloud, and then trying to evaluate whether that makes more sense than using the managed service. And, you know, the reality is that those are not apples to apples comparison. You're comparing a control plane of many SQL technologies to managing a SQL engine on your own compute on a rented server. And, you know, I see that comparison happen over and over and over when people look at workloads and it's like, these are not like, this is not what you're, these are not the same thing. So really sort of a lot of effort I spend on being a center of excellence is really defining that and teaching the business what is the apple in this comparison and what is the orange and what is the value of these two things and why sort of comparing them directly doesn't make any sense, right? You need to evaluate them for fit for your workload. And does it solve a business problem for you? Then it's the right solution. You know, if you've got a really robust, you know, DBA team that has a really, you know, tight management of all of your, you know, SQL databases, do you need RDS? Probably not, right? You might be able to do it faster, cheaper, depending on how that is, but you have to evaluate it that way. And people don't really look at it that way a lot of times. They're, you know, they're either thinking about how expensive the cloud service is and how cheaper they can do it on premise, or they're just evaluating, you know, things, performance values that aren't the same across these two things and not really willing to consider the appropriate trade-offs because that evaluation isn't happening correctly.
Yeah.
I mean, the cloud by default is not cheaper.
No.
Like whoever tells you move to the cloud to save money doesn't, unless if they understand your business, doesn't know what they're talking about. You know, it's not cheaper unless you use the services, you use the, you know, dynamic abilities of the cloud to use the spot, use the reservations. You really dive in and you really look at it from like a FinOps perspective. But like you said, you know, use the right tool, the right place, and all at the right time.
I think there's some definite selling points for multi-cloud out of the gate. One would be physical location between Azure, Microsoft. Microsoft Azure and Google and AWS, maybe there's 100, just over 100, 120 maybe.
If you add Oracle, you're at like 250. Yeah,
I'm not adding Oracle.
Those are in a truck.
Location is globally. And sure, they have some pretty good coverage, but they're also very tightly clustered in some very similar places, like, you know, US Virginia region, entirely data centers. Like I heard data centers are going to get to vote in Virginia. There's so many of them, they almost outnumber the population. But yeah, I mean, I think physical location is going to be very important if you have really latency sensitive applications. If you need to have something local, then sure, multi-cloud might make sense for at least the pieces which do that, like last mile, kind of talking to either devices or customers. That's probably a good point. Sometimes
I think data sovereignty is going to be more impactful there. I think the latency will solve with technology, you know, caching and different, you know, edge devices. But data sovereignty is going to be the real key for regions and, you know, looking at a multi-cloud strategy, because this cloud provider has a region in the right place, you know, is going to be.
So I think the data sovereignty is definitely a piece, but I've definitely seen cases where companies have done their last, you know, the initial ingress. You know, these are fairly sophisticated companies where everything is containerized and they're using Nomad or Kubernetes at the edge everywhere, but they want that low latency. So they want those point of presences, those pops everywhere. And, you know, I've seen them where they've done their own, launched their own stack just on general compute nodes, but then put their stack on top of it. And a company I worked with specifically launched like one in Africa, I think, because, you know, I think Microsoft was the only one that had a location in there. So they built a whole Azure multi-cloud strategy because of that initially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that expanded it. So I think that last mile, if you're talking about like anything that's extremely latency sensitive, like games or anything like that, is definitely something that could come in and is a valid reason for multi-strategy.
Yeah. And of course, on the flip side of that, there's definite reasons not to go with a multi-cloud strategy, and things like vendor lock-in is at the top of my list there. You're going to be locked into one thing, or you can be locked into three things, which is worse.
Yeah, I hate that argument for like, oh, no, you should have a workload that's agnostic on a cloud provider because of vendor lock-in. You'll be able to pit them against each other for better negotiated prices. And that is not a reality that has ever existed in my career so far.
Yeah.
Like, I wish.
I mean, most of them all have similar services, though. So sure, I'm just going to choose Kubernetes because it's easy, right? They all have a Kubernetes service that you can use. They all have a SQL service that you can use. So are you really locked in that case? Sure, if you start talking about queues and message buses, or if you're using, you know, PaaSes or anything like that, yes, they might be a little bit more specific. But, you know, for a lot of the stuff, it's not as vendor lock-in as people like to say it is.
I've never seen anyone be able to sort of pick up a Kubernetes workload and move it simply, right? The reality of being able to leverage multiple cloud providers and say like, well, I'm just going to move all my stuff, it's just not a reality. There's too much complexity surrounding that workload. So even if you dive into containers and Kubernetes and you try to keep it all agnostic, you make sure not to leverage any of the, you know, the native storage platforms or native managed services, it's too difficult to pick up something and move. And so like, it's just not a reality that you need to plan for anymore. Yet it still comes up in arguments when you're sort of, you know, deciding an architecture. Like, I've never had to not argue that point.
Has anybody ever seen someone be like, we're moving clouds because of this? I mean, I've heard people talk about stories of it, but I've never firsthand, you know, or even secondhand been like, we're moving because we can get a better price from this vendor. So we're going to move our full workload and take on a full migration. Like, I've just never experienced that or heard of it.
Not anything of size, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, I have friends' personal projects that they've moved, you know, that kind of thing, you know, like, it's the complexity is just, it makes it manageable. And so like the only realistic, you know, multi-cloud is in, you know, someone who adopted multiple clouds in self-defense to take advantage of a feature that one cloud had, or because of an acquisition or a region, right? Like, I've seen that. I've seen a cloud expand into multi-cloud. I've never seen one switch.
I think expanding is a different story. Oh,
completely.
And then I also think when you start to take on a multi-cloud strategy, you know, you're starting to, you know, really, if you're going to, you need to take it from day one, like when you first moved to the cloud. One, build the business use case. Two, make sure that you're covering all your security and governance, you know, compliance, everything along those lines that you really need to take on. Because sure, you're running config and guard duty and all these things, but now you got to run all those things here. And then are you going to send all your information from one to the other? Are you, so your SOC team going to actually look at two locations now? Or are they going to get annoyed at you for doing that? Most likely. Are they actually going to look at it? That's a different story. You know, but these are all more things that you need to take into account. So sure, yes, we want to go launch this, you know, new feature, you know, over here because it exists, but don't forget about all that other baggage that at a company of any real size that you need to take into consideration.
I think pricing is prohibitive for multi-cloud because most network traffic within a zone doesn't cost you anything. Cross zones starts to cost you a little bit of money. Internet egress, incredibly expensive.
10x.
Yeah, right. Expensive. I thought AWS was expensive until I saw Google's premium internet tier, which is obnoxious. I couldn't imagine like going into a build out of an architecture that deliberately wanted multi-cloud for some kind of superficial reason, simply because the cost of data exchange between different providers is just phenomenal.
I mean, I've changed application architectures within a cloud because of that reason. I can't imagine trying to do it between multiple clouds. Like,
you have to do it over, Direct Connects, or, the equivalent, link it back to a standard thing or use some sort of third party. There was one that I've worked with in the past that built like an MPLS network and you route it all over. That way you get the lower price point for all of it. For cross, cloud traffic costs because you're now going over your backbone, not, their public internets. But at that point, if you're setting that up, then that's now a critical service. You need redundancy there, whether you use your internet as a backup. Then you have site to site you have to manage. Like there's a lot of other things that come up along the way.
It just kind of sucks to have to have a data center, or at least a presence in a data center in order to take advantage of cloud. Like I want to get out of the data center business. And I don't want to manage fiber connections or anything else.
There are companies that will do it where you don't have to go all the way back to a data center. I can't remember them, but I've definitely talked to them and worked with them.
Much like a multi-cloud strategy, someone deploying a software-defined WAN also should be doing that against their will. Like should not be doing that because they want to or because they think it's a good strategy. Like, no, this is because they have to.
Yeah. It is expensive. Multi-cloud is expensive for lots of reasons. And I think one of the things I've harped on about over the years is just the cost of compliance, just the cost of taking those controls and mapping them into policies or procedures. But for one cloud, it's expensive. For multiple clouds, I can just can't imagine. Like the subtle differences between every implementation of everything everywhere just means that's an enormous amount of work. You need a massive team of people skilled in those very specific clouds. I don't think so. Like I cannot imagine that the cost saving benefit at least of being in multi-cloud, if you happen to get one service cheaper somewhere else, would ever outweigh the expense of having to manage multiple clouds.
Yeah.
And then to make a comment that hits way too close to home, but now I got to report back to my CFO about all these different clouds and how to tag everything, to make sure that I can actually report up through the business. Hey, these things in this cloud, and this piece over here and this piece over there. And I realize I'm using my hand to point on a podcast, which is highly inefficient, but we're going to bypass that, and then trying to map all that back together to say these three pieces and these individual clouds all are this one service. And hey, this gets charged back to this department. Like that's a nightmare in and among itself too.
Yeah. Trying to do that efficiently in one cloud.
Yeah. Right?
Especially with tagging differences and all the different resource differences you have between like an Amazon account versus a Google project or an Azure subscription, I believe. Like
good job.
Woo! There's a reason why FinOps is a growing practice and why, this is basically a new role that's only been in existence for a year or two. It's because the complexity of managing all of that across a very distributed workload, it's hard and you're going to have to dedicate resources. So, we've abstracted a whole bunch of, cloud jobs by, leveraging cloud providers, but just like any advancement technology, you know, it's created this other job that we now have.
Yeah. I think lowest common denominator is my worst fear about multi-cloud, though, in that if you only choose to use the services that you can migrate easily between clouds to avoid, you know, in quotes, vendor lock-in, you end up with the crappiest, worst, probably most expensive way of doing anything that you were ever going to do in cloud by not taking advantage of managed services and the sort of the expertise and the orchestration that they provide. So yeah, I think lowest common denominator is the big concern for me, at least.
Yeah. I'd argue that I'd rather have a data center workload and manage it end to end, including the power and the cooling and all the things, than have that lowest common denominator defined service. At least I'd be getting all the benefits, you know, of tightly controlling my workload and the ecosystem it lives in.
Yeah.
At that point, you're renting compute. Like, I don't know what else you're doing besides renting compute that at a 30 to 50% premium.
Yeah, we may as well have a colo someplace and get it for a 25% of the cost. Yeah, as far as pricing goes, I think I don't see huge differences in the pricing for services which have parity, especially compute. And so,
yeah,
I mean, as a small business, I would go with the easiest possible implementation for whatever I'm trying to do. And right now I'm incredibly biased still. And, you know, maybe DigitalOcean is the right thing. Maybe AWS is the right thing. You know, if there's a get started guide and it saves you a few hours, go with that. Because the pricing isn't of that much consequence in the end. I think as you become larger scale and enterprise and you start getting negotiating power because you're spending, you know, millions of dollars a month on services, then you start to get these, you know, huge enterprise discounts and incentives to do all your business there. You know, the more you spend, the more you save.
And it normalizes the cost. Like, it really does make it sort of a non-event.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe you get a 10% discount for an enterprise agreement committing to a certain spend over a number of years. That 10% is going to be more than the delta in cost between any cloud you could pick. So really just pick one, go with it.
Yeah.
Especially adding in the complexity of actually moving it. Like,
yeah.
You're having to support it twice, running it at, you know, alongside each other for that time while you're transitioning over. Like, no way. Yeah.
The one thing I would say is, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't consider things like Gmail or O365 really part of the cloud per se. You know, and I look, you know, I work at an Azure company for my day job, you know, and I look at these resumes that I get and they're like, oh, we know Azure and it's really O365 administration, which has nothing to do with all the cloud services. So in my head, I don't consider some of these things. So while you might use O365 for your email, AWS, I don't really consider at that point a multi-cloud strategy, you know, because this is really like email and business productivity versus, you know, your product or anything along those lines. Maybe that's not the right approach, but to me, those are very distinctive, like, lines in the sand of like, this is like your SaaS solution and this is like your corporate IT internal stuff that, like, you know, I'm not using AWS Workmail for my company email. I think I've spun it up just to set up fake domains to use for 15 minutes and turned off, you know, but it's, you know, those that I don't consider a multi-cloud strategy, I think is kind of my point of this.
Yeah, that's fair. I think about cloud is the primitives that I use to build my own services, and those other value add services like Workmail, those are costs of doing business, but they're not things that I use to generate revenue.
It gets funky though with the introduction of no code. If you think about all the different options you have with an O365 subscription, where you're dabbling with that sort of application space with there. But yeah, and mostly I agree. Like, I've had O365 host my email in the last three companies. So, like, and all different cloud providers. So I'm like, man, yeah, it makes sense. It's a different ball of wax.
So,
I know on their line items, they merge them together and make everything look good, but they're really different.
It adds to your negotiating power if you've got a large contract, right?
Yeah.
So thumbs up or thumbs down for multi-cloud?
If you are being held at gunpoint, you should adopt a multi-cloud strategy. Otherwise, no.
I'm still not sure that you should.
Yeah.
Be like, I will do it, but the person with the gun, yeah, give me your credit card. Give me your credit card number.
What movie was it where the guy robbed a bank with a phone? Was that a Pulp Fiction reference? It was a Pulp Fiction reference. Yeah. It's, I feel like you're robbing your own bank with multi-cloud. All right, I think we've flogged that to death.
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
Long-time listeners are like, yeah, this old chestnut.
Yeah. Justin, yeah, please come back and save us.
He does rein us in, doesn't he? Yeah.
Justin must like his family because he's always eager to kind of get out of here. But we were like, how long can we drag this out for?
Yeah. Let's talk about multi-cloud.
Oh. I'm on the East Coast. Yeah. Mine's asleep right now.
Good for you. read the subtext in that. Thankfully, subtext doesn't hit the Apple filters.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys. It's been entertaining. I'm sure Thank Justin will provide his critical feedback when he gets back from his cruise.
He's just going to slowly shake his head.
He's just going to delete it from his phone. No, I refuse to listen to that episode. No. It took you 15 minutes to send it off. We're good.
No, you hang up. No, definitely. Yeah. I would be hanging up if I could find the stop button. All right. Yeah. I'll see you next week.
All right. Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
And that is The Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.